Joining us from Jerusalem is Mr. Jamie McGoldrick, the interim UN resident and humanitarian coordinator in the occupied Palestinian territory. Thank you, sir, for taking the time to speak to us today.
No problem, Ezra. Good to hear from you.
I wanted first to ask you about this news that came out yesterday. Israel informed the UN that it will no longer approve any UNRWA food convoys to northern Gaza. How is this going to impact the humanitarian operation there? And hunger has already claimed dozens of lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think the IPC report that came out last week showed quite clearly the deterioration and malnutrition rates in the north in particular. And we've seen a 70% decrease in people's ability to, sustain themselves. Any interruption to a food supply that's already very fragile is a wrong move. And we've had conversations with Israel to see if there's any way we can find a getting a way to pass through this. And to see if we can then get the trucks that we need every day into Gaza. Right now, it's very precarious, it's very intermittent, and we are lucky if we're getting 10, 15 trucks in at any point in time over a 2 day period.
Okay, and what are the agencies that are still able to reach if you're getting 10, 15 trucks in?
But at the moment, it's WFP and also World Central Kitchens. And UNRWA was the third leg of that. That was the most part. There's other organizations like Catholic Relief Services who put a little bit in there as well. And that will expand as the roads open. There are three roads that go north to south where we supply into it. And at no point in time in the last weeks and months have we had any more than the two of those routes. And now, even today, we just have one route that's open for us to get into the north.
Right. And have you been in contact with the Israeli side to discuss this decision? Is there any going back?
Well, in terms of, there's obviously a problem with Israel and UNRWA. We know that because of what's happened since the tragic events of the 7th of October. And we also know that because we saw last week when Philip Lazzarini, the Commissioner General, wasn't allowed into Gaza. So there's clearly an issue there that they want to try and address. I want to try and get away from that and deal with getting the trucks, getting the food that's here into the north. That's how we do that. Who we do that with is immaterial. It's the food that's important, not the agency, the organization.
Right, and can it be done without UNRWA? I mean,
Well, I mean, we're using private sector trucks to move stuff and plus our own
sure.
trucks as well. So we can get stuff to the north if the roads are open. The roads have been open that regular, as I mentioned, and we've struggled to get all of the routes open from north to south or south to north. And that's something that we are working on very hard. We're trying to get more trucks in to make sure the supply is available. And for us, I don't particularly care whose organization brings the food in. All I'm looking for is to make sure that we get more food than we're currently getting in. I was up there last week and I saw directly the impact of the lack of food supply on children in the Kamal Adwan Hospital.
Yeah, that actually brings me to my next question. You've been on this job for a few months.
Yeah.
You've made multiple visits. How do you see that the situation is developing over that time period?
I mean, in the south, I've noticed every time I've come in, and I've been coming in on a weekly basis since I got here in late December, and I've seen a significant change in the situation in terms of an increase of congestion in the south and Rafah becoming very overcrowded, squalid living conditions, unsanitary conditions. But then, as the Rafah incursion became a possibility and it's been in the news and people are fearing it, there's been a depopulation of the Rafah into the coastal area called Al-Mawasa, which was the area that Israelis had designated a safe area. So there's now about 400,000 IDPs in that area, displaced people. So it's an area that was not that congested, it's now becoming quite congested. And that's one of the things you notice about it. However, at the same time, all of the people living in those areas and tented areas and unplanned tented city locations, they're not getting the service support, water sanitation, they're not getting the food supply, there's no medical points. That we're trying to play catch up with that right now. So that's where we are. In the north, I've been able to go to the north twice because it's been so difficult to get there. And I managed to get this week through the Kuwaiti Junction, Sakhalin Road, I got to Bet Lahia. And went to the Kamal Adwan Hospital. And I went there because that was the hospital that was recording and reporting the deaths of children through nutritional malnutrition issues. So I met Dr. Usman and the team there and walked around the hospital. I went to the ward itself, the children's ward, and it's absolutely shocking to see what's there. Every single child in that ward has nutritional deficiencies, have emaciated, they're on drip feeds. Some of them are worse off than others. Some of them, they've got complications such as hepatitis A or intestinal infections, and all of that's weakening their immune system. And days before we got there, there was some children who died, and some of the children in that ward are in very, very bad condition. WHO will move two of the children out from that because they're so severe, one with a brain tumor and one with cystic fibrosis, will be taken south and hopefully then out to Cairo and further afield to get the treatment they need. And then when you go to the neonatal ward, there's very few, there's not enough incubators for the children. Some children are doubled up. Some children don't even have incubators. And then one of the children I saw there, because the mother was so malnourished that the child was born 2 days earlier and was only like 1.2 kilos in weight. So these are a clear indication that food insecurity and malnourishment is starting to hit that population very hard. The doctor says that there's like 18 to 20 children that they have recorded has died. And that number, that's the ones who come to the hospital. And there's ones who won't get to the hospital because of other complications there as well.
So, with this horrific situation that you just described, despite it, the Security Council has thus far failed to reach an agreement to demand a humanitarian ceasefire, which is what every UN official, including yourself, has been calling for. What is your message to council members? What do you need from them?
Well, I think there's been ample warning given to everybody who's watching this situation, and everybody's watching it, that the politics are the reason why we're not getting the cessation of hostilities that we're looking for to get more assistance in to reach more places. And this ample warning is out there that's shown that if we don't do it, the IPC is a flag of our joint responsibility and also our joint failure. The hostilities continue. We see the hospitals are not as protected as they should be. Right now, Shifa has been under pressure. Nasser's under pressure. Last night was the Al Amal hospital, because there's allegations that they are harboring Hamas and others. So the situation is not getting any better, and we've seen that the IPC shows that we've failed and are failing. And if that doesn't give you a wake-up call in the Security Council when you've got the chance to vote for something that makes a big difference to people's lives, then I don't know what to say.
Just hypothetically, let's say if the Security Council did adopt such a resolution tomorrow, what would that mean in practical terms on the ground? What would it change?
Well, I think it would change in the sense if there was a ceasefire and we could get then the ability to move goods through and safely without checkpoints, without over scrutinized, and to get all the roads opened up there, and they wouldn't have this need for inspection and sort of very delayed, sort of, I would say, dysfunctional, undersized inspection systems that are repetitive and unpredictable and bureaucratic. If we could remove all of that at the same time, increase the supply chain from Jordan. As we had in 2014, right now we've got very few trucks coming from Jordan. We need to get 20 or 30 a day in there. If we could get opening crossing points in the north opened, and we could get the three roads in the south and the kinetic activity, which is stopping those roads from being operational. If military activity stopped, those roads would be free. And we could supply very, very fast throughout the south and clearly into the north as well. So a ceasefire it's the most important thing we need right now to get that supply into all those people who we know are really struggling.
People around the globe are seeing the images of hungry children, and they're saying, how could this be happening in 2024? And yesterday, Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke of, and I quote, he said, "The daily assault on the human dignity of Palestinians is creating a crisis of credibility for the international community." Meanwhile, on the other side, there's a narrative being pushed that there are no restrictions on the amount of humanitarian aid allowed into Gaza. How can all of this be reconciled?
Well, I mean, there's been this sort of long-standing tit for tat saying who's responsible and where the problem lies, where the solution should be. I mean, we all know before the war there was 700 trucks a day were coming into Gaza. Right now, there's only 250 on a good day. So the gap between the needs and the supply is massive, and it's been constant for the last 6 months. And so, no matter how you cut it, you cannot satisfy the needs that are there through the number of trucks we're bringing through there. And Israel might allow all the trucks they say they want to come through, but they can only max out at 250 trucks a day because of their scanning and their inspection regime. And unless that was laxed, unless we opened up more corridors from Jordan, unless we moved up the Ashdod port was to supply properly into it, we're never going to get to the 700 trucks. And we need to get the private sector back engaged again, because they were the lion's share of all the goods that came into Gaza, supplying the material that we don't, because the pharmacies, the supplementary foodstuffs, and just basically goods that people want to buy, that has to change. And right now, it's not a situation we can say it's going in the right direction. And I think the IPC, going back to that measurement, tells you the supply is not working.
Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffiths said that he wanted to settle this debate on what's impeding aid coming into Gaza, and he mentioned that the current humanitarian crisis is the result directly of Israel's restrictions. So how can the impediments that he spoke of be removed? How can Israel be compelled to remove those impediments and bring in this flood of aid that the SG spoke of?
Well, I think the first thing is not to just have one channel for delivery. And right now it's Kerem Shalom through to Rafah and into Gaza. That's a very narrow bottleneck. We have to load and unload the trucks. It takes time. We then have to take them out. Inside, people are in a very desperate situation. So the insecurity that's caused by that desperation makes it difficult for us to move trucks around. And it's a sort of catch-22. We have to get more trucks in to prevent the insecurity caused by the desperation. And then, in order to actually expand the pipeline, you have to open up more areas. For example, Jordan has only 50 trucks a week. We should be getting 30 trucks a day, and not having to come through Kerem Shalom, because they're scanned already in Jordan. They should just come straight into Gaza and then go straight into different parts and the crossing points. Ashdod in the north is a well-equipped, functioning port. It's international. We've been using it for decades to supply Gaza, and now we no longer use it. They have the capacity to scan goods, and we could easily use that. So a combination of Kerem Shalom in the south, we have Jordan on the coming in from the east, and have the north, the Ashdod port. We could satisfy all the needs that are required there, but that means Israel has to allow those to open up, and they also have to allow longer working hours in Kerem Shalom. And then Kerem Shalom writes that we don't work on a Saturday because it's Shabbat, and half day on a Friday. And yesterday it was closed because it was a public half day, because it was a public holiday. So they're not in the mindset of being in an emergency to facilitate maximum throughput for Kerem Shalom at this point.
You spoke to us a little bit about Rafah. You said that it's being depopulated, and there have been multiple calls to avoid an all-out offensive on the southern city by UN, by member states, by many parties. How has the UN prepared itself to deal with the results of such an offensive, being that Israel seems to be insistent on carrying it out?
Well, is that to be perfectly honest with you, we're not ready, and we won't be ready. In the current context, unless there was a ceasefire, we can't bulk up the support into Gaza the way we need it. We are living on a sort of a hand-to-mouth existence, with having 250 trucks a day coming in to feed the population. We are lucky in any given day we've got 2 to 3 days' supply. And that's really problematic for preparations for any incursion that might happen into the most congested area in the Gaza Strip, and the place where we need as that supply point, Kerem Shalom and Rafah. If there's an incursion there, it will break the back of our response. And we are not able then to pre-position foodstuffs. And water will be a big issue because of the weather. It's starting to change and become very hot. The sanitation issues are still clearly a problem, and the shelter issues. If people are forced to move from Rafah right now, and the assumptions are it will be a large scale incursion, therefore there could be up to 500,000 to 900,000 people moving. We cannot cope with that. There's nowhere in the world you could cope with that number happening that quickly, when we right now are in such a fragile situation in terms of our ability to address the current humanitarian situation. And right now, we're in a contingency planning mode for addressing the current humanitarian catastrophe. And for that to be then doubled up by making people move, we just wouldn't be able to do that. It would be massive in every sense.
I did want to ask you also about some images coming out of Gaza of like markets being full, that there are products, produce, and some of, obviously this is not all over Gaza, it's in certain areas. So how can this be explained? And then on the other end, you have these extreme images of malnourishment in other parts of the strip.
I've seen the pictures that you mentioned, but I've also been in Gaza many times and I haven't seen the reality. I don't know where those pictures are coming from. It's not the bits of Gaza I drive through and go through. You see occasional right now there's been the harvest of like aubergines and tomatoes and stuff is happening right now. This is the last harvest. There won't be another harvest. This is the residuals of some potatoes and other or products there. So that's one thing. In terms of meat products, I haven't seen meat of any kind coming into Gaza. The livestock that's there is struggling because of the lack of fodder and lack of grazing because of the hostilities that are ongoing. So I'm not sure where people are getting those pictures from. It's not the same parts of Gaza I see.
Of course, you are a veteran humanitarian and you've worked in many complex situations. How has this job measured up compared to the other important roles you've played?
A couple of things. I mean, I would say that, I mean, I feel as though we haven't done enough. I haven't done enough, and I think that's shown in the results of where we see where we are. And it's not through any fault of the hard work, the massive work that's done by, Gaza staff from with the UN organizations and NGOs, despite the fact that themselves their lives have been completely turned over, lost family members, lost their livelihoods and their houses and all that stuff, yet still come to work. So that's one I would say is a massive positive. On the negative side, I would say is that the way this has been politicized and aid has been instrumentalized for the way we are working right now. And I would also just say that, as a crisis, it hasn't been measured in this way in terms of the intensity of the totality, in terms of impact on population, of the speed by which this has happened, and the lack of hope that's built into this situation. And I've never seen, I've seen it in pockets in other places, but I've never seen in such a mass scale as this one right now.